Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. We are into the crunch week of the membership stage of the Tory leadership contest. At the weekend, postal ballots will be sent out and the expectation is most members will vote straight away rather than waiting over the next coming weeks. That means all the campaigns are at pains to get their message out. And Jeremy Hunt has taken a bold stance today, trying to play up his no-deal credentials with a £20 billion plan. So, Fraser, what's in Jeremy Hunt's no-deal Brexit plan?
Well, quite a lot. I think this is the most impressive and serious thing we've seen from Jeremy Hunt so far. I mean, his team think that they are pretty much neck and neck with Boris amongst Tory party members. Now, that might be delusional, but I spoke to one of them yesterday and that's exactly what he thinks. So they know that they will have to compete on how serious he is about leaving on the 31st of October. And to demonstrate that he's more serious than Boris, he's come up with a plan, a no-deal plan, for what would happen if we were to leave on the 1st of November. That would involve £6 billion for farmers and fishermen, who obviously be affected in the short term, £13 billion in a corporation tax cut for every company, cutting the rate from 19% to 12.5% straight away, and then about another £1 billion of other stimulus with the kind of, they're seeing it what would you do after an economic crash? This is exactly the right question, because when countries hit headwinds, governments can immediately respond with stimulus, and not just the Bank of England lowering interest rates, that's the button we press most of the time, but there's a £27 billion war chest set up by Philip Hammond. Now, why I think this matters is because, first of all, a lot of people reading this will think, well, this sounds quite good. This doesn't sound like a nightmare scenario. And Philip Hammond ought to have been talking about this every week he was Chancellor, to demonstrate to the other side that we were serious about no deal, therefore that would increase the chances of a deal. Hammond didn't do that. He did the opposite. He only spoke about disaster. So I think Jeremy Hunt is going a lot further than Boris Johnson in saying how he would get through that, and saying that he is also more serious about Brexit than Boris, who only paints in these broad brush strokes and bangs on about 14th century Tunisian economists rather than coming out with hard plans.
Now, James, it's clear that Jeremy Hunt has provided a lot of detail and more than I think Boris Johnson has in his few media appearances so far. But when it comes to this, there is also the sense that Jeremy Hunt has said many things about Brexit in his time as a cabinet minister. And most recently, he wrote an op-ed in which he suggested that he was sceptical about no deal because it could lead to an early election before the UK had left, and then that would be disastrous for the Tory party, and therefore he was suggesting that he was someone who was willing to extend. His comments at the weekend on Andrew Marr, when he talked about if by early October it didn't look as though a deal was possible, he would go for no deal, combined with this today, does that mean he has performed a U-turn on no deal?
I think the problem for Jeremy Hunt is that if you look at the nuance, you can reconcile all of his different Brexit positions. But they're quite hard to put on a leaflet. And up against Boris Johnson's crude but effective October the 31st, we're leaving, come what may, line, I think they struggle. I think the aim of this today is to say to Tory members, look, if we are going to take the risk of no deal, don't you want it done by the person who's kind of done the detailed work, the planning? As Fraser was saying, it's an attempt to kind of draw a contrast with, you know, look at the Jeremy Hunt detail against the Boris bluster is the not so subtle message of this pitch. Looking at the detail, a lot of it is a reheating of things that Jeremy Hunt has already said. The farmer and fisherman stuff is new, but the stuff about the corporation tax cut, increasing the capital allowances business, all things he said in that interview with UKT.
Except he did them straight away, that's the difference.
At the beginning of a campaign. And I mean, the other question for him is on Brexit, you know, is he seen as credible by the Tories electorate? And I think in a way, in this campaign, he is paying the price for Theresa May's sins. I think the problem is that Theresa May has slightly cleared the pitch for anyone who voted Remain in 2016, because people, Tory members, feel that they've seen this movie before. People tell them that they voted Remain, but now they've converted to Brexit, but they're going to do it, they believe in it, that Brexit means Brexit, and then it doesn't happen. And I mean, that is Jeremy Hunt's big problem. I think the detail of his plan is an attempt to get over that hump, but I still think it is a big jump for him to get over.
Fraser, does this change your opinion of Jeremy Hunt's suitability to be the next Prime Minister?
It does a little bit, I have to say. I was pretty unconvinced about his pitch, especially given that his language seemed to be I don't want to do no deal stroke, I don't want to do Brexit. He seemed to be pitching himself as the Remain candidate, in other words. I think he's worked out that that's not a very sensible pitch when you're looking at the 160,000 Tory party members, two-thirds of whom would like no deal pretty much as their first option, but don't really want to do a deal that drags negotiations on for another 2 years and then might lead to another disappointment at the end of it. And also, he's been doing something I've been wishing the Conservatives would be doing for years, to actually describe the many options that we've got to soften this blow should it come to that. I mean, Britain's a country with its own central bank. We can print as much money as we want. This is a tool which European economies simply don't have. This is why Greece and Spain and Ireland were so badly affected by the crisis when we weren't, that we have the ability to deflate and they don't. And also, I also think that only by demonstrating that you are actively willing to go through with this, you're willing to walk away, will you get a deal. My first preference, by a long margin, is to get a deal. And I think one is far more likely if you actually not only say you've got a plan, but detail it as well, especially if so many aspects of that plan turn out to be quite attractive. Of course, the caveat is simple. Does Jeremy Hunt really believe it? Does the man who was saying pretty much the opposite 6 weeks ago, can he be taken credibly by saying, coming out with his I'm ready to do no deal on the 1st of November, come what may shtick? Now, I am not entirely convinced, but I guess this underlines what is for me a growing concern about the Boris campaign. I really would have thought that by now we would have heard more of this sort of thing from Boris. Sure, we know that he's a campaigner, he paints in broad brushes and all the rest of it, but you'd think that we would along the way, have a little more detail. And one of my niggling concern about Boris, I'm afraid to say, is that what if behind the jokes and bluster, there lies jokes and bluster? Like, he hasn't yet demonstrated that there is a hard, credible plan to take Britain through what would be one of the greatest challenges we'll have had in our post-war history. It takes more than fine speeches to do that. Now, I've always argued that Boris can do this. I've found myself defending him against the great many people who think he's completely useless and that he couldn't. I think he's perfectly capable of him to doing this if he gets the team together. But I haven't seen the team, I haven't seen the policy, and I'm starting to get a bit nervous.
James, is Jeremy Hunt's move today in this speech going to put more pressure on Boris Johnson to start talking about details rather than believing?
Yeah, I think that is part of it. Part of the strategic aim of this speech is, you know, Hunt's details versus Boris's so-called bluster. And then I think the other thing is, he's trying to put the pressure on what does no deal actually mean. I think one of the things about Boris Johnson is, if you gave Boris Johnson truth serum, he is convinced that no deal isn't going to happen. Because he thinks as soon as you've got a British Prime Minister who's prepared to put no deal on the table, you then see that the dynamic of a negotiation changes. You then get a deal that can get through Parliament.
Well, he's told us he thinks there's a million to one chance of that not happening.
A million to one chance of no deal, yeah. I think there is a challenge there, because I think at least initially, the EU's instinct will be to call Boris Johnson's bluff. They will want to do that for two reasons. One, to kind of see how he responds, but also crucially to see how Parliament responds. On Tuesday, we'll have the latest effort to try and tie the Prime Minister's hands and block no deal. This by essentially taking the budget of four government departments hostage. And I think that this is the challenge. One of the things that the EU will want to see is, how does Parliament respond? Does Parliament turn around and say, if the EU tries to call Boris Johnson's bluff or Jeremy Hunt's bluff, and say, okay, right, that's it, no deal, and then see if Parliament steps into the gap? And I think that is the current likelihood.
I wonder, James, how Boris or Jeremy Hunt would go around persuading the EU of the credentials here. Would they have an indicative vote in common saying, here's what we intend to propose to the EU, let's have a vote to see if it would pass? Do you think they'd have to do something like that to persuade the EU that it will deign to give a concession to test Parliament's water itself?
I think the thing that tests the EU's resolve the most is to demonstrate that there is a deal to be done that can get through Parliament. And I think that voting that through and then saying, look, we can pass this, does help. I also think
the Brady Amendment's done that, hasn't it?
They would say that the Brady Amendment is too vague, the EU would say. And I mean, also there is another problem, which is that Theresa May, again, not to heap all sins at her door, but she did repeatedly tell the EU that this or that would get the deal through Parliament. And the EU gave her most of this or that quite often. And then the deal went down to defeat again.
And finally, we've spoken about whether Jeremy Hunt's pitch can really convince Leave voters or Brexiteers that he is serious about no deal. But what about those supporters in the parliamentary party who veer towards a softer Brexit? Amber Rudd is one of his loudest cheerleaders, so to speak, yet has repeatedly said they don't want to be anywhere near a no deal. Do you think there's a risk that this is going to turn some of this support away?
I think they will not like this very much, but the question is, what do they do? Are they prepared to bring down a Conservative government and run the risk of a Corbyn government? Because that basically will be the option. Tomorrow you're going to get Dominic Grieve testing his votes, where he's asking MPs if they would be prepared to cut off funding for public services to stop no deal. I don't know if he'll succeed there. I suspect not. But I think people like Amber Rudd will soon find that much as they might not know no deal, we are getting towards binary choice territory. If the EU don't give a deal, then it will be either no deal or the Tory party credibility is destroyed and the Brexit party driving coach and horses through the Conservatives' hopes of survival. So I would be surprised if we see more than five Tories say whether they're willing to vote with Corbyn. We've seen so far Tobias Elwood, Oliver Letwin, Ken Clark, just three. And I'm not even sure Tobias Elwood's thought it through properly, so I'd probably put that down to two. We've also seen people like Oliver Letwin and Rory Stewart both say explicitly that they would never vote against a Conservative government to put Corbyn in as a Brexit gambit, because they didn't think Corbyn would do any better on Brexit. And also, the other thing that we've seen is that an attempt to keep both sides on board fatally stymied Theresa May's approach. It's difficult to do this half-heartedly. Either you are prepared to go for no deal and you stand a very good chance of getting a deal, or you think no deal actually terrifies me, in which case why would the EU budge? But I'm not sure why Boris hasn't used Sajid Javid to make more of these economic arguments. We're going to hear Matt Hancock giving his economic speech, and some of his points I find deeply unconvincing, I'm afraid to say. He talks about automation being a great threat to people in the north, and that's just economically untrue. I mean, the problem people have got in low-wage jobs is that companies haven't invested enough in machines to take people into higher-paid jobs. Sajid Javid, I think he could take on and defeat Jeremy Hunt in terms of no-deal preparedness. I'm not sure Matt Hancock could. So I think Sajid Javid, who we keep reading, is Boris Johnson's most likely choice as Chancellor. If that's true, then why not wheel him out? Why not use...
There's a slight problem that Sajid Javid hasn't actually endorsed Boris Johnson yet.
Yes, exactly. And if I were Boris, I would be trying to do that deal pretty quickly. I think he needs him right now. I don't know. I imagine Sajid will end up endorsing Boris. But right now, Boris needs somebody who can out-detail Hunt. And I think that person is Sajid Javid, if he can be persuaded to come into play.
Thank you, Fraser. Thank you, James. And while you're here, why not take us up on our subscription offer? 12 issues for £12 and you get a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to www.spectator.co.uk/voucher.